Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the lovely Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of free, untrammeled thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And John, I've already weighed in a little bit on our topic for today, the 100th episode of Philosophy Talk. I've been ruminating about our past and future. Well, what about you? What are you thinking about our past and future?
Well, the way I look at it is this, Ken. I mean, for 100 Tuesdays, we've been coming up here, spending a couple hours at KALW, shooting a big hole in our Tuesdays.
That's true.
And expecting listeners around San Francisco, around the peninsula, and indeed around the world to join us for an hour. What do we think we're doing?
Well, I'll tell you one thing we're doing. We're having a great time. I mean, I don't know about you, but philosophizing is really fun. And doing it in the midst of all these smart people, having them join in, all these cool guests, it's like the best public kick I've ever had in my life.
Yeah, let's emphasize that when you and I talk about philosophy, what we mainly have in mind is not reading stuff written a long time ago or even a few weeks ago or discussing the thoughts of other people, but doing philosophy, taking any subject whatsoever and say, well, what are the basic assumptions? What are the basic concepts? How are they supposed to work? How do we know? What do we mean? Questions like that. And it's not only fun, it's actually pretty useful, don't you think?
I agree. I mean, I have to tell you, I think that our culture, our public discourse especially, is utterly debased. It's full of BS. It's full of mendacious, misleading propaganda. It's meant to manipulate rather than enlighten and inform, you know, and shock and entertain, but never really give you meat for a sober reflection. And it's a disease that we've caught. And I think philosophy is one elixir, one magical elixir for helping to cure that disease.
Well, you know, I think in the days before radio, say in Greek times, there probably was a lot of garbage being spoken all over Athens. Probably Bill O'Reilly, Zorba the O'Reilly or something was up there pontificating away. But there was also Socrates and his friends doing philosophy. That's what's endured. That's what's lasted. Now, Ken, I knew Socrates, and you're no Socrates, but we do our best. And I think it's not only important and fun. It actually has some, it ought to be politically relevant.
Oh, right. I mean, think of our first episode, Bush's doctrine of preemptive self-defense. A doctrine supposed to be kind of a systematic body of evidence and belief that kind of hangs together. But that was just, that so-called doctrine is a bunch of, well,
hooey.
Yeah, that's a nice word for it.
Assumptions, pictures, and undigested
thoughts.
And I
think we helped to expose that.
Yeah, I suppose we did. And, you know, but one thing that was put to rest on that first show was my fear that we wouldn't have any listeners or that they wouldn't participate. I remember a woman called in. I had used the analogy of Marshall Dillon on the streets of Dodge City. If he draws first, that's preemption. If he draws second, that's self-defense. And she said, well, this was just after not too long after the Iraq War started. What if he draws and instead of shooting the guy at the end of the street that's trying to shoot him, shoots the shopkeeper up on the side that he never liked very much?
So we got some smart.
We got great listeners and great callers.
You know, and we not just have, it's not just we have great listeners and great callers. I think philosophy itself is in really good hands because the younger generation coming up, taking up philosophy, they're also really, really sharp. Our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, actually asked some of our own graduate students about the modern appeal of philosophy, she files this report.
In honor of Philosophy Talk's 100th episode, I asked several graduate students of philosophy about the central issue that occupies their minds.
The issue that I spend most of my time working on is intersubjectivity. So how do people know about one another? How do people perceive one another? One example that I like to give is an in-joke, right? You'll say something, the other person will say something else, and you'll sort of feed off each other and build off each other until you sort of, you know, you have rutabaga at the end, right? And every time you say rutabaga, you and your friend just, you know, crack up laughing and you both sort of know what that means. Helping people understand how their relationships with other people work, that's sort of where I'm going with my work.
My dissertation is on the topic of self-deception. For example, when people go to the gambling casino convinced that they're going to win all their money back, Well, my question is, what is the mental state of a person who's deceiving him or herself? Where does the capacity for this mental state come from in humans? It seems like knowledge contributes to the evolutionary fitness of human beings. But on the other hand, if that's the case, why wasn't the capacity for self-deception weeded out?
Philosophers like to think of themselves as being very rational people, and philosophers like to think of the study of philosophy as the study of rationality. And it's usually not very clear what that entails, what that amounts to. Usually, when philosophers try to explain what rationality is, they connect it up with justification. And so they say something that we do or something that we believe is justified, and then we're being rational. And there are a lot of issues there, and I think philosophers are very often quick to just say, well, we understand what rationality is, we understand why it's good to be rational, and then let's look at all these other things about what kinds of beliefs, for example, are justified. But I think we need to do more ground-clearing work on what exactly rationality is, especially in the context of personal choices and personal decisions.
What I'm working on is trying to figure out what it is that we do when we ask ourselves what to do. So basically the issue of practical deliberation or practical reasoning. So for example, a decision that a lot of people have to face is when they leave college, they have to decide what career to go into. And human beings seem very different in that they think about what they should do. And I'm trying to explore what that means.
Metaphors can connect any two items in a sense. And the problem of how to do computations when any piece of information that you have in your brain could possibly be relevant to the computation is a very tricky problem, because if you suddenly are presented with a completely new situation that you've never seen before, you have to figure out a new way of interacting. And humans can do that really, really well, and robots can do that not at all. That's sort of the central question that I'm interested in now. It sort of grew out of this interest in metaphor and language. There's still a lot of room for stepping back from our preconceived notions and evaluating them again, and philosophy is a place where we can do that.
From the front lines of philosophy, I'm Polly Stryker.
Rutabaga.
I'm John Perry. Thanks, Polly. Thanks, graduate students. This is Philosophy Talk. With me is Ken Taylor, and this is our 100th episode. We'll be speaking with a number of past guests to find out what they're doing these days.
And first up is Anne Ashbaugh. She was last in the program talking about the erotic and the pornographic. That was a scintillating. I really loved that discussion. Anne's a professor of philosophy from Colgate University. She's currently visiting professor at Rutgers University. Anne, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hi.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anne. This is John Perry, and I just wonder, you know, you've probably moved from the erotic and the pornographic in your philosophical thinking to something even more stimulating, scintillating. What is it?
Immortality.
Immortality. Oh, terrific.
Is that connected to your concern about the erotic, or is this like
definitely
non-bodily connected. Immortality?
No, it's actually connected in the sense that I'm looking at Plato's idea of the immortality of the soul insofar as it relates to coordinating and fulfilling all our desires, the desires of the soul. And so, one of those is erotic desire.
Tell me more about that connection, because, you know, my conception of immortality, not that I believe in immortality, but the one I was reared on had to do with your soul living forever ever, and your body kind of disappearing, right? And maybe you get this, I forget what it's called, this reconstructed body in heaven or something like that. But you know, I never thought of any eroticism in heaven with just souls and no bodies.
Right.
I mean, is the Platonic conception of immortality more bodily based than that or something?
It's related to the body, but it's really the soul that desires, and it's really the soul that experiences erotic pleasure, even though it is, in fact, in conjunction with the body. So I'm now looking at, well, what is it that a soul could actually retain having experienced a body? And why is it that Plato can make such a claim?
So now, and in Christian theology, the soul is usually considered necessarily immortal. If you think it's only contingently immortal, you've committed the Socinian heresy, which I could talk about at some length, but I won't.
Thank God.
is Plato's soul necessarily immortal?
No, I do think that, in fact, the soul dies. And I think what I'm hoping to show is that if the practice that the soul has is one of fulfilling the desire to know, the desire for victory, the desire for pleasure, all of them together in a particular way, the soul then retains its life. But that in fact, if any of those desires is withered, that in fact the soul dies.
Oh,
yeah.
Dear.
Immortality
is, there was a beautiful editorial in the New York Times. I think it was this morning, or was it last? I read it last night, I think. And it was the oldest person in the world just died. And on the editorial page, they wrote this beautiful editorial lamenting the passage of the oldest person in the world. But there was this line in there about how all of us expire, and there comes a time when you just run out and all that. You know, I'm not sure immortality would be. We did a show a long time ago, whether immortality would be a good thing. I don't know if I want to be immortal.
How about you, Anne? Would you like to be immortal?
I'm not sure. I think what I'm trying to figure out is whether one's identity can be immortal, right? We're talking about a self. Mm-hmm. We're not talking, I'm not sure. I think immortality may be actually overrated, but I do want to see to what extent this philosophical project that Plato presents in the dialogues is aimed at immortality rather than being aimed at anything else.
Well, you know, the way I think of it is like this. Every hike I've ever been on has been 2 miles too long. Now, it's not like I don't want to hike at all, but just they always turn out to be 2 miles too long. Now, I'm sure when I die, it'll be...
Even your half-mile hikes,
yes,
right?
I'm sure when I die, it'll be 2 months to 2 years too soon. I don't want to live forever, but I suspect I'll always want to live another couple months, couple years, or maybe just a couple of minutes. But who knows?
So I don't...
Sounds fascinating.
So put a question out to our listeners there. Should we do another show on immortality? I mean, you know, lots of people... Not too many people believe in immortality of the soul. What about you? Do you believe in immortality? Should we do a show on that? Give us a call. Tell us what you want to see on the next 100 episodes of Philosophy Talk. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Tell us what you want to see out there. So, Anne, you know, it was really great having you on for our erotic and pornographic episode. That was really one of my favorites, and we'll have to have you back again sometime to talk about immortality.
Thanks for joining us for our 100th birthday.
That's great. Okay. Thank you. Pleasure and congratulations.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the 100th episode of Philosophy Talk, and we're celebrating with some old friends of the show.
We've heard from Anne Ashbaugh, who originally joined us for a discussion of the erotic and pornographic. Now she's kind of moved on to higher things. Next up, we'll check in with Anthony Appiah. He's been with us twice in the past. Wants to discuss race and wants to discuss the ethics of identity. You can't get much more deep and abstract and profound than what he's already into, but we'll see.
Yeah, and we'd like to hear from you, too. Comments, suggestions, give us a call. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We'll take your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Jack Barry Realtors is proud to support Philosophy Talk. JackBarryRealtors.com. 415-564-0225. Real estate services for your business or home since 1969. Wicked, Wilson, Pickett, and 99.5 just won't do. You gotta have 100. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. It's the 100th episode of Philosophy Talk, and we're having ourselves a party, looking back on where we've been and forward to where we're going. And we'd love to have you join in the fun.
The number is 415-841-4134. I'll repeat, 415-841-4134. Tell us what you've liked. Tell us what you'd like us to do. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Our next guest has been twice on the program before today.
And that would be Anthony Appiah, one of my favorite intellectuals, professor of philosophy from Princeton University. Anthony, welcome to our party. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, happy birthday.
Oh, thanks so much, guy.
So, Anthony, word on the street, and let me tell you, the gossip about Anthony Appiah and what philosophy books he's up to is just all around the hood, is that you've been finishing a book called Experiments in Ethics about the relationship between experimental moral psychology and neuroeconomics. Now, and I understand, but what's experimental moral psychology and what's neuroeconomics?
Start with the neuroeconomics, because that one really puzzles me.
Experimental moral psychology is when psychologists do things by taking people into labs and studying what goes on in their minds or brains when they're thinking about moral questions.
Right.
So people do functional magnetic resonance imaging of the brains of people thinking about those famous trolley problems that philosophers talk about.
Yes. Yeah, tell me what the trolley problem is really quickly. I don't know if all of our listeners will.
The standard trolley problem is if you've got a trolley coming down a track and it's got two options, and one way, if you leave it alone, it'll kill three people, and the other way, if you intervene and divert it, it'll only kill one. Should you intervene? Most people think the answer to that question is it's probably required to intervene, or at least permissible. But they don't think, on the other hand, that if you are faced with the same sort of situation, but the way you have to stop the trolley is to push a fat man over a bridge,
right?
They don't think you should do that. And from an abstract point of view, it looks like they're the same, because you're basically allowing the trolley, you're stopping the trolley killing three people in order to save one. But it turns out that people have different reactions to the two different cases.
Right, and you can't actually really put people in a situation where they are faced with a real-life trolley problem.
No. What you can do, though, well, you could, of course.
But, yeah, but that would be kind of mean.
You wouldn't get a grant for it, and it wouldn't get through the human subject research panel.
Yeah.
Well, one of my ambitions for when I retire is to build a model railway that has all the different versions of the trolley problem exemplified on it, with little automatic fat men you can push over. What's neuroeconomics?
You can't study people actually faced with these problems, because you can't put them in that situation. You can't even pretend to put them in a situation like that. It's not fair. But what you can do is look at their brains when they're thinking about these questions.
Yeah.
And make the assumption that what goes on in their brains when they're thinking about this is a little bit like what would go on if they were actually faced with the problem in real life.
So now, is the neuroeconomics about the kind of dynamics of the interactions of the neurons, trying to figure out kind of...
Now, curiously, neuroeconomics neuroeconomics is done by experimental economists. And they do, if you like, moral experimental psychology focused on situations where people have to make decisions of a sort that you would make in an economic context.
Oh, I see.
So they're basically in the same line of business, but they're driven by an interest in different psychological questions.
Gosh, you know, this sounds like really fascinating stuff. And in this short kind of party format, we can't really dig into it. So you know what we're going to have to do, and if you're willing? We're going to have you back for another episode of Philosophy Talk.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
Anthony, I think you ought to get some of these guys, you ought to go back to your first book on conditionals and see what parts of the brain light up when we listen to conditionals.
Yeah.
Well, Anthony, thanks for stopping by our party and joining us for our 100th episode.
Thanks a lot, Anthony.
Happy birthday.
Well, before we go to our next former Philosophy Talk guest, we're going to take some callers.
Yeah, we've got Eric in Berkeley on the line. Welcome to our party, Eric. Hey, are you there, Eric? Oh, we seem to have lost
Eric.
There you are.
They've changed my name on me. My name is Ed.
Oh, Arid? Oh, I'm sorry.
And Yahoo, aren't we having fun with this party?
Okay.
A 100, man, it's been a good ride.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. So what do you want to tell us about the past or the future? What should we be doing? What did we do?
I don't know if I missed it, but have you ever done one on the mind-brain problem?
Yeah, we've done, we did the Mystery of Mind. We did a show on consciousness with David Chalmers, a show on the Mystery of Mind with John Searle. But we could do more because there's a lot more to say.
So you can go and live stream those past episodes, but I'm sure if you stay tuned for the next 100, you'll hear a couple
five charts. That chart the whole thing, and it's published by somebody down at Stanford. We saw it up here at UCB, and you know, Searle gets a whole chart, which I think is unfair.
But okay, but Arid, we'll take that one up again. Thanks for calling. Rashid in Berkeley is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rashid. Welcome to our party.
Good morning, and peace to you. I wanted to make a comment on the immortality discussions you were having earlier. When I was raised and went to Catholic schools until I got into engineering school, which I don't know if that ended my Catholicism particularly. Actually, I had some doctrinal questions with the church. But one of them was that it would come up often in classes. They'd talk about the state of the souls in heaven, and the heavenly state is supposed to be a perfection of all human experiences, and sexuality would seem to have to be one of those.
Well, that's so certainly from any experience that I've had. I agree with you about that.
There should be sex in heaven, but I'd always get into trouble if I ask that question and have to go to the back of the
house. Rashida, here's what I want to tell you. A heaven in which there's no sex is not one I want to go to.
Well, I tell you, Rashida, they should not have been so hard on you, because one of the great saints of Catholicism, Saint Augustine, asked somewhat the same question in the City of God. He said, what was sex like in the Garden of Eden, which is supposed to be like heaven? And he went on for a couple pages thinking about it.
Right.
Augustinian. Well, I went to a school taught by Augustinians, but they never liked to deal with that question from 13-year-old males.
Not too surprising.
Rashid,
any questions about sexuality from 13-year-old males, they tended to back off.
Well, definitely. Rashid, thanks for stopping by.
In the Islamic conception, there's definitely sexuality in heaven, and it goes on. And Ibn al-Arabi talks at great length about this in a bunch of his books.
Well, okay. We're going to have a show on sexuality in heaven.
And there we go. Thanks so much for stopping by. Now we've got one of my all-time favorite guests, not a philosopher, but a very philosophical psychologist. That's Allison Gopnik. She's professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. Allison, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you.
Okay, great. Well, wonderful to be at this party.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us, Allison. Now, in the past, we've talked to you about imagination. That was great. And also about nature versus nurture. That's important. But now you're talking about the consciousness of babies, I understand. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this was actually provoked, as it were, by some philosophers. It's been a long question about what it is that it's like to be a baby. What kind of consciousness do babies have? And lots of philosophers in the past said that babies didn't have very much consciousness at all, basically.
Yeah, they're just mewling, you know, pooping, peeing things.
Well, even on theoretical grounds, people argued that if you didn't have language, which obviously very young babies don't, you couldn't have consciousness of the sort that we grown-ups do. And what I've been thinking is exactly the opposite. I think babies are actually more conscious than we are.
Oh, yeah? Why would you think a thing like that?
Well, here's the reason. If you look at what babies do versus what grown-ups do, what babies are good at and what grown-ups are good at, what babies are really good at is learning new things about the world and learning lots of new things about the world all at once. What they're really bad at is doing anything very well. So, you know, they can learn three languages at once, but they can't tie their shoelaces.
Yeah.
They can't do anything swiftly or efficiently. And we grown-ups are really good at doing things really efficiently and automatically, but we're terrible at learning new things, or at least we're not great at learning new things. And if you think about what it's like to be a grown-up, the times when we're really conscious, when everything is vivid, when we're noticing everything that's going on around us, when we're really in tune with the world, are those times when we're doing something like we're traveling or we're falling in love, and everything is new and we're having to pay attention.
Yeah, I see what you mean, but let me throw out a challenge really quickly. This is what we do in Philosophy Talk, you know, thesis and antithesis. I mean, the things that babies learn to do, they learn them so effortlessly and automatically. It looks like they're given over to kind of innate kind of instincts in a way. I mean, really complicated stuff. I mean, they learn language without thinking. They learn about objects without having to puzzle about it. It's just all this machinery in their head that does the work for them. That's kind of subconscious.
Well, you know, so that's the question. I'm not so sure they do it without thinking. You know, one thing that we know about babies, for instance, again, sort of like, you know, the people, like someone going to a new place or falling in love, is they wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning crying. They get pretty exhausted, you know. They're pretty intense. Watch their little faces sometimes. It's not like when they're trying to solve a problem, nothing's going on in there.
Well, yeah. I find your view pretty plausible. I just got a dog for the first time. I have had a dog in about 20 years. I've been watching him a lot. And nobody has to tell him to stop and smell the roses. Well, I mean, you might have to tell him to stop and smell the roses as opposed to something else. But, I mean, they have this kind of living for the moment that as adults we have to strive for.
Well, you know, you know what? This is worthy of exploring in detail. So, Alice, I'm going to issue an invitation. Come back on and join us again, and we'll do a whole hour rather than just a few minutes to this topic. How would that be?
I would love to. Nothing I enjoy more than being on Philosophy Talk, and happy birthday.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us and being part of Philosophy Talk 100th episode party.
Thanks so much, Allison. Now let's go get some more callers, Ken.
Yeah, we've got Josh in San Francisco. Welcome to our party, Josh. What's your comment or question?
Hi, congratulations. Well, in the spirit of questioning everything, I want to congratulate you on the celebration of the arbitrary fact that we're a primate with 10 digits on our forelimbs and that our mathematical parts of our brain love to multiply all numbers by themselves. Mm.
So, okay.
So you're making the point that 100 is a pretty arbitrary thing to celebrate.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you know what? Tradition is always arbitrary, but it grows up. I mean, Seinfeld had his 100th episode, and Friends. I was looking on the web the other day at what did people do for their 100th episode, and everybody does it, so we're just part of a tradition. You think that's not justification enough?
He's making the deep point that you can be justified in celebrating a perfectly arbitrary milestone.
Thanks a lot, Josh. Ione in Piedmont on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ione.
Hi. Thank you, and congratulations.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed. I would like you to talk about immortality again and juxtapose it with some of the thinking of the mystics and the, you mentioned Augustine, and other contemporaries like Eckhart Tolle that hypothesize that it's letting go of the concepts and then we touch something so beyond our experiences that we are immortal. We touch immortality.
I think it's a great topic, Ione, and let me encourage you to go to Amazon or your local bookstore and get a book called A Dialogue on Personal Identity and Immortality. It's written by one of my favorite authors.
That would be you yourself.
Yes, me. Me, myself.
Okay. Right. Thanks.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks so much. You know, I think that's a great topic. And the mystics, all that stuff, I've gotten more respect for things sort of non-analytical as we've been doing this show.
Oh, dear.
We're joined by another of our favorite guests. That's Professor Janann Ismael. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Arizona. She's currently a senior fellow at the Center for Time at Sydney, Australia, and she joins us now from Calgary, Alberta. Janann, you're globetrotting, but welcome back to Philosophy Talk as you trot around the globe.
Thank you very much, and congratulations on your birthday.
Well, thanks, Janann. You know, the philosopher Whitehead, who you probably read, had this thing called the fallacy of simple location. It sounds to me like you're single-handedly pointing out the fallaciousness of the idea that at least a young philosopher like yourself can belong to any one location. But last time we had you on, we talked about quantum mechanics, and now you've got a book coming out called The Situated Self. What's that about?
What's the situated and what's the self? Tell us about both those things.
Well, the self, I mean, it was partly actually dovetailed quite nicely with your previous caller, which is kind of an account of how the brain does metaphysics, an understanding of, if you think of metaphysics as an account of the most general structure of reality, what sorts of things are there in the world, what are the basic constituents, what kinds of properties do they have, and so on. You can think of a lot of what I was doing in that book as an attempt to understand how the brain does metaphysics.
How the brain does metaphysics.
Yeah, how we learn to sort of parse experience into an image of an external world from the information that comes in through the senses.
I see. Now, parse experience into an image of the external world, but we just don't have the external world. I take it as part of this, right? We have the self against the external world. Here I am over here, and here is the external world over there. And old Descartes taught us that, the external world's a problem, and the self is given immediately and clear. Do you believe that kind of stuff?
No, actually, I think they're two sides of the same coin. So the idea being, what we do have is experience, and that we learn to objectively interpret experience or interpret it as experience of something distinct from ourselves. partly by separating out the subjective and objective components. So the self part of that is just the subjective components of the experience, and that needs to be projected out or abstracted from the appearances in which they become completely melded into together.
This sounds deep and difficult and profound stuff. I mean, so some people think that the self is, there could be nothing more evident than the self. It's just right there, right? I mean, why do you believe that the self is not, I mean, what would make one believe quickly that the self is not just immediately given independently of the world?
Well, you might go back to what Allison was thinking about. I mean, the baby consciousness. Does the baby think of the world as myself perceiving the rose that I'm smelling, or is it just kind of all one blended thing, the smelling of the rose? What do you think, Janann? And tell us about immortality while you're at it.
One way to think about it is, well, what exactly is the conception of a self? And in my book, I actually argue that the idea of the self is a bit of a misnomer for what is actually the separation out of the reflexive component of experience, the part that is sort of, as it were, refers reflexively to itself, to experience, and the projection of that against the background of something independent of experience. So an objective interpretation of experience presupposes a distinction between experience and what experience is of. So, for example, the appearance of the chair and the chair that it's an appearance of, those two things are distinct. And the real mystery there is, how could we ever get from the idea of experience, the idea of something independent of experience that experience is supposed to be of? And the suggestion in the book, and it's part of a long tradition that that comes from Kant, and probably much farther back than that, the idea there is that what you have to do is read into experience and structure that's not intrinsic to it.
So, Janann, a couple of mundane questions about your book. Who's publishing it? Is it out now? And if not, when will it be out? How can we order it?
It's coming out with Oxford University, and it's not out yet, but it should be out soon.
When it's out, your first stop on your international book tour, since you're an international traveler, has to be Philosophy Talk. Will you agree to that?
I'll insist on it.
Okay, there you go. Janann, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great having you as part of our party.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for being a part of the 100th episode of our program.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're having a party.
We've just been talking with Janann Ismail from the University of Arizona, Allison Gopnik from Berkeley, and Anthony Appiah of Princeton. Coming up, we're going to check in on Martha Nussbaum, who most recently talked to us about justice beyond boundaries.
And we want you to join us, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can send us an email, too, at comments@philosophytalk.org. Join the party when Philosophy Talk continues.
Okay, Roman, are you ready? Can you hear us? Is the level okay? Are you
awake
still?
Yeah, you want us to talk some more? Okay, so take it away, Johnny Boy!
This is Lyle Bremser, the voice of the Nebraska Cornhuskers, coming to you from KFABAM in Omaha, Nebraska.
I'm Ken Taylor,
and I'm tired.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
We're going to make this up as we go.
This is Dizzy Dean with Pee Wee Reese. It's the mutual game of the week. Boy, he slid into third like a house of fire there. This is Edward R. Murrow reporting from the roofs of battle-torn London. This is, who the hell was his name? What was his name?
Is that one of those dead white guys that some people think define philosophy?
Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?
Ken, you don't have to spell it right in a script that we're going to read on the radio. I'm fulfilling all my radio fantasies here. I hope nobody minds.
Are we done? Is that a wrap?
I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except our producer's intelligence for putting all those outtakes on the air here. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're celebrating 100. If that threw you folks, it threw us too. We're celebrating 100 episodes of Philosophy Talk. What burning philosophical issues would you like to hear us take on in the next 100 episodes of Philosophy Talk? Let us know by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Or you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org. Be sure to tell us what you thought of my interpretation of Dizzy Dean and Edward R. Murrow.
I didn't know
that had been taped.
Oh, gosh. We were just vamping that day. We're joined now by Martha Nussbaum, all the way from the Netherlands, one of our favorite all-time guests. She's a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. Martha, welcome to our party. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, and congratulations to you. You do a great show, and it's great to celebrate it.
So, Martha, you have actually been our most frequent guest 3 times.
Wow.
Emotions,
wow.
Friendship, and justice. That must just cover the spectrum of every possible deep and profound topic that you could be thinking
about. No way.
Actually, I hear you're thinking now about the intersection of philosophy of education and political philosophy. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of my last book, I said, well, if we're going to have a just world, we have to start thinking about how to produce it. And so we really have to be thinking about education. And so that's one of the things I'm going to talk about over here. What worries me is that I think there's this rush to technical and market-oriented education in all countries, and maybe even more in Europe than in the U.S.
More in Europe than the U.S.?
Philosophy and critical thinking and training the imagination to be able to tune in to the experiences of other people. So those things are going out the window, and sort of we're producing nations of docile engineers, I think.
Martha, I think you're entirely right. I agree it's a deep and profound problem. I was actually thinking about that. I was listening to another show that airs here on KLW, Your Call This Morning, how the arts have been cut out of the curriculum in California because of Proposition 13 and the struggles to get it back in. And the educators were saying that the arts educate the imagination.
Yeah.
Right? They're uniquely powerful at educating the imagination. And I think so much of what's happened in education has downplayed the need to educate, train, enliven, embolden the imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you can see that things go bad when you don't do that. And in India, where I spend a lot of time, the states do things very differently from each other. And there's one state which for a long time has had nothing but engineering and no arts and so on. And that's where the worst religious violence has taken place. And I think it's not accidental because, you know, if people can't imagine other people as really fully human and imagine what they're feeling, well, then they can do what they like to them.
Right, I agree with you. Moral imagination is like one of the deepest, most important things. And one of the other things I think we're lacking is leaders who can kind of embolden our moral imagination. So, I mean, I think the connection between what you're education and politics, educating the imagination, I think you're right. I think it's deep and profound. And it's certainly worthy of an entire episode or 2 or 3 of Philosophy Talk.
Yeah, we should do that sometime. Because I think, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, those were people who really knew how to tap into the imagination and the emotions through political rhetoric. And, yeah, I think we do lack that.
Why? Well, how do you think this has happened to us, that we no longer kind of systematically try to educate the imagination?
Well, you know, I think there's such a pressure for success in the global market. I mean, actually, India's gone down this road a lot further than the U.S. has because they even have a university system where you just do one subject. So, I mean, most of the schools are preparing you to go to the Institutes of Technology and Management, and it's all stuffing full of facts and rote learning. And their legacy was so great. I mean, Rabindranath Tagore, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1914, also was a school founder, and he founded founded this great progressive school that did everything through the arts, and he himself was a dancer and a choreographer. So I've just organized a conference last year celebrating his legacy, and you know, it was quite amazing to see that everyone was agreeing that that was a lost legacy, that no one wants to go in for that anymore because they're not going to make money. And I think it's the drive for financial success in the global market.
But
it's very short-sighted.
But can these? I mean, in a way, training the imagination, literary education, philosophy to a certain extent, these are kind of upper crust things, you know, people do that are preparing for a life where they don't really need a job. Now, that's impractical anymore. Can we somehow combine the imagination and philosophy with preparation for a reasonable career of the sort that engineering or economics can provide?
Well, you know, I disagree very strongly because I've spent a lot of time looking at education for the rural poor in India and, you know, outside the public school system. And when people want to get children into school who are working during the day, they lure them in through things that make sense to them, that seem to have something to do with their lives. And so both the adult education and the kids' education for these very, very poor people are full of imagination and critical thinking. Because how else do they come to terms with their own situation and what they want to change about it?
I agree with you entirely, Martha. Look, my own story. I went to the university determined to be an engineer because working-class black family, upwardly mobile, one of the earliest members of my family to go to college and actually finish, you know, and I could not have envisioned a life of philosophy when I headed to the university. Could not have envisioned. It was outside the boundaries of my imagination. I encountered these wonderful teachers who fired my mind up about this abstract discipline and offered and opened up a realm of possibility that just was off my radar screen. And I just think we shouldn't say to people from rural or working class backgrounds, you are going to be a farmer, or you are going to be a factory worker, you are going to be at the bottom rungs. We should say, imagine a life for yourself. Imagine, let your imagination be completely untrammeled, right? So I agree with you entirely.
Let me get the comments of you two veteran and thoughtful philosophers on some email we've got here. Josh John in Berkeley says, have the experts on animal rights ask Coco, assuming he can speak, would you like to go back to your ancestral home? What if he says yes? Would that be the right thing, even if we knew it was bad for him?
I know. Martha, you've thought about animal rights.
Well, yeah, I think with higher animals, it's really complicated to, you know, when they live with people and they can learn language and so on. Is that, how important is that if they can also go back and live with their own with their own original group? And I don't know. You know, I think that teaching chimps to speak is more interesting for us than it is for them, probably. And I don't think that that's part of the flourishing of a chimp. But on the other hand, you know, there was that monkey in New York who lived for many years with a family and had become really very human, and they decided that he was an endangered species and they'd have to take him away from that family, put him back in the wild. And I thought that was cruel because he had learned to live like a human being, and so at that point he's not going to go back to the
jungle.
Yeah,
it seems kind of sad, be like putting me back in Nebraska after I've learned to live in California.
Right.
Well,
hey, we've got some callers who want to join this party. Sandra in San Francisco. Welcome to our party, Sandra.
Oh, hi. I'm going to skip all of the wonderful side trips you've invited by these wonderful discussions and just say what I told the young lady.
Okay.
Which is, I think it would be interesting to explore on some program the extent to which contemporary physics is no longer a material science. It seems to me that contemporary physics is now a philosophy itself. It's an internally consistent series of propositions, and they use mathematics as their basic tool, but anything from the material world, such as whether something can be in two different places at the same time or whatever, they say that's an illusion if it doesn't accord with the philosophical precepts of physics plus mathematics.
You know, Sandra, I think you've got a real point there. I tell philosophy students, you know, materialism, that's a very intuitive view that belongs to the 18th century. things are, you know, just smaller and smaller material particles. But today we shouldn't talk about materialism. We shouldn't confuse physicalism with materialism, because physicalism means that physics is at the bottom of everything, and by physics we mean whatever the physicists tell us is going on, and it's not very intuitive at all.
Sandra,
so that'd be a great program.
Yeah, it would be. Sandra, thanks for stopping by our party.
I think to explore the connections between science and the arts is really important. One of my favorite schools, a progressive school in Massachusetts, is building a science and art building. So the science teachers and the art teachers are going to interact in lots of ways. And I think physics is an imaginative construct, after all. And so we should explore those connections.
Let me get two more emails. First, a good idea from Gertie, who says we should talk about the notion of purpose. And she explains how it's at the bottom of a whole lot of other things we're talking about. And then here's a kind of a practical question from our old friend Pete in San Francisco. He says, congratulations, you guys. Now tell us, what are the most exciting areas in philosophy right now? Where are the innovations? And what are the names of people and books, films and schools that we should be reading? Well, of course, Martha Nussbaum and everything she writes, right off the bat. But who else should these philosophy talk listeners be
the
reading?
The four people we had on before, Martha. I mean, they're all, you know. We have really high-powered guests who are doing works at the frontier. And what really pleases me about these high-powered guests is that they're willing to talk to a broad public. I mean, and it's not like they're talking down. They're talking up. They presume the intelligence of a broad public. And I think that's a great development in philosophy. What do you think about that, Martha?
Yeah, I want to say that I think that this public is great, and I want to applaud you all, because here in Holland, philosophy is very popular. It's popular everywhere. There's a big-selling magazine, and the publicity person at the firm that does my translation said, well, you know, when I'm going on vacation, I pick up Philosophy magazine, and that's the way it should be. But it isn't that way in America enough, and I think you guys are doing that.
We're working to make it better.
You're doing it with the help of these wonderful people out there.
Like you, Martha. Like you. And we really appreciate all you've done for Philosophy Talk, and we'll have you back, and we'll talk about your latest thoughts. Okay, you promise to come back?
Okay, great. That would be wonderful.
Okay, so thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.
Martha Nussbaum is from the University of Chicago and has been speaking with us from the Netherlands.
Thanks to all our guests today, and we also want to thank all the callers and emailers we didn't quite get to.
Yeah, but you know what? We still want your ideas, so drop us a line at comments@philosophytalk.org. Comment on that blog post that I put up. Tell us what you want to see in our next 100 episodes. So, John, how do you feel about being a wise old centenarian?
Well, you know, in terms of years, I'm not quite a centenarian. I am getting up there, and as long as
if we're still doing philosophy when you're a centenarian and I'm almost a centenarian, boy, whoo. That'll be something.
You know, Plato said getting old wasn't so bad. I think getting old isn't so bad if you don't, you know, kind of slip over your own drool or something like that.
Yeah.
You'll forget a lot of things, but most things aren't worth remembering.
Anyway. What about back to 100 episodes?
Yes.
I mean, we're just getting started.
100
really
episodes
young.
Of what?
Yeah. We're just getting started, don't you think? I mean, we're just getting warmed up.
Yes. We're just getting warmed up. Another 100, another 200, another 500. Who knows?
There we go. And we're just a juvenile. And there's so much. You know, somebody once asked me when we first started this show, how are you going to do a philosophy show week after week after week? What are you going to talk about? Well, the answer is we're going to talk about everything that at all puzzles the mind and the imagination. Because there's philosophy everywhere.
We could do a show on mud. I mean, you know,
How
watery does it have to be before it ceases being mud? How thick does it have to be before it starts being dirt?
That's not one of those deeply gripping things, though.
Oh, there's mud that's deeply gripping. Have you ever put your foot in gumbo?
Oh, John. Anyway, look, this conversation goes on, right? On our blog, on our webpage. And also, you know, if you have a problem that bedevils your mind, submit a conundrum. We haven't had one of those in a while. Submit a conundrum. And check out my blog entry on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago.
You can download podcasts from our website, Final Thought, Man Who Can Go From 0 to 100 in Less Than 60, Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, so this is Philosophy Talk's 100th episode. What is it about the number 100 that's so special? Why celebrate that rather than, say, the 87th episode? When we talk of each generation getting older all the time, what's the hurdle? That's right, living to 100. People who live to be 100 are called centenarians. And how do we divide our history? Into centuries, 100-year units. Who will receive the door prize? The first 100 customers. If your mother's told you something once, she's told you 100 times. It's 9 out of 10 agree, or 99 times out of 100. There's no in between. 100 is the top 10 on steroids. Among other lists, we get Time Magazine's top 100 people who shape our world. We get things like the 100 greatest movies of all time from the American Film Institute. But that list includes The Sound of Music, which, in my opinion, makes the list only 99 and a half. And as the gospel song has it, if you're going for 100, 99 and a half won't do. For some reason, a president's first 100 days are always a benchmark. The 100 days in France marks the time between Napoleon's return to power, his defeat at Waterloo, and the restoration of the king. I don't know if it was exactly 100 days, though. It might have been a few hours or so either way. Horton the elephant, who hatched the Who, was faithful 100%, so 100% would seem to be the maximum one can give. And yet, Sammy Davis Jr.'s daughter said of her father, he couldn't just fulfill a contract, he had to give 300%. But then, that was Sammy. Though Justin Timberlake has been quoted as saying, if you put out 150%, you can always expect 100% back. That doesn't factor in entropy, but you get the idea. Remember Chairman Mao? Let 100 flowers bloom. Let 100 schools of thought contend. By 100, I think he actually meant many. Then there's the 100th monkey theory, that when enough monkeys learn a new behavior, the rest of the monkeys spontaneously adopt it. These are probably the same 100 monkeys who, if left alone in a room with a typewriter, will eventually write Shakespeare. How many pennies in a dollar? When you're getting anesthetized, what do you count backwards from? The 100 Years' War was actually 116 years, but we don't talk about that. One last thing. If 100 indicates best, why is a beginner's course called Philosophy 101? To find out, I'll be enrolling soon, and believe me, I'll give my studies 300%. I gotta go.
That was Ian Scholes, Digging Deep, Digging Fast, the 60-Second Philosopher. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.